Ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, wow.
This is a special edition of The Most High Show. I'm your host, Christian. With me is Sarah.
With a what?
With the H.
Hello.
And today we have an in-studio audience. Hello, guys. Joseph's on the ones and twos. Leslie's doing quality control. And my man Chad Smith is in the building, and he is going to be sharing his story. And, you know, it's going to be... It won't be bad for long. That's all I got to say. Okay? So stick around.
We're going to work through it.
Yeah. You know, we haven't done a story in a while. Mm. Kind of, we amassed this library about 150 recovery stories.
Right.
And I was kind of like, okay, let's start getting, try to do other creative things with it, right? But I think yours is a perfect story to come back to do the story. We've talked about it a lot.
Right.
I know a lot of your story. And so the purpose of sharing stories is because we know that there are people since the beginning of time, humanity has related to each other through stories. I mean, through the caveman drawings on the wall,
right,
up to where we are today with, you know, thousands of content that's getting streamed every day. It's all story, right? And story makes us feel not alone. It makes us feel connected. It gives us a greater sense of purpose. And so when you're here sharing your story, you're taking part in that. So thank you, Chad. Yeah, and thank you to everybody.
Thank you for letting me be here.
Yeah.
This is an awesome opportunity.
And thank you, Dean, for clapping like there's more people here. Appreciate that.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
So, Chad, we like to start the story time with what you do now, where you're at now in your life.
In my life, as of this week, I'm an intern here at Most High Media. Yep. Thanks to you guys, a paid intern, so I'm learning a new skill set and hopefully something that'll be a career one day. I have a girlfriend that I live with. I volunteer a lot of my time at our local RCO back in Holly Springs, The Rock, and also its partner, Hope Dealers Worldwide. So I spend a lot of time there, participating in meetings, helping organize them sometimes. I've got 3 small children that I get to see from time to time all the way down in Noonan. You know, I get down there as much as possible. I got 2 young boys that play baseball, so I enjoy those things, you know, and live life.
Yeah.
Try to live life.
All right. Move the mic a little closer to your... Just, yeah,
a little there quiet
you
man.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And so you've been clean, sober for a while?
Yeah, going on 18 months, the 17th. So a week from today will be 18 months that I've been completely clean and sober.
Is this the longest you've had?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. I spent all of my adult life and most of my teenage life in active addiction. So this is by far the longest time I've ever had.
So in these 18 months, what's been like, and I'm talking about your inner world, what's been the greatest gift you've received internally?
Peace. I always kind of relate it, in my mind, I relate it to being okay with me when I lay down at night, like when I'm alone with my thoughts. If I'm good at the end of the night, then I had a good day. Like I'm peace, I'm serene, I'm happy. And it took me getting sober and a lot of struggle to really learn that. I saw something on TV this morning as I was leaving the house that said, the greatest things in life aren't things at all. And that peace is like my greatest thing nowadays, so.
Yeah.
What kind of TV are you watching?
it was a reality show. Believe it or not, it was a reality show. And I heard a guy say that. And I kind of stopped as I was going out the door and said, wow, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. I don't.
So it wasn't always peace, though.
No.
So do you know when you started using drugs and alcohol as a solution to your problem?
When I started using drugs and alcohol? early. I was like 11 years old, man. I started smoking weed the summer after fifth grade. And being that I have two young boys, one of them in fifth grade, that's a terrifying thing for me as an adult, as a parent. I'm like, oh my God, I see this kid playing baseball. And I'm like, that was me, except I went another route, you know, and I played baseball. I played sports as a kid. So it started very, very early with just weed, alcohol, some pills.
Yeah, but it's like at that point, it's kind of social. It's fun.
Right, right. It was recreational. It was entertainment in a way.
Yeah.
Was this in Noonan?
Yeah.
So how, at like that young of an age, how do you know what it is that you want to do it and where you find, like, how is that presenting itself?
That's a good question. It didn't start in Noonan. It started in South Fulton County, which is like South Atlanta, which is where I was born and raised. And so I went to school down there, you know what I mean? Like in South Fulton County, where it was tough, like, so I hung out with some older kids. You know, there was a lot of drugs, a lot of street knowledge that I gained at a very young age, like, you know, 10, 11 years old, cussing and just rebelling against everything always. And I think it was like 13, my mom actually got remarried and I moved to Coweta County to Noonan, which was like stepping into a Disney movie from where I came from. It was like, but I took that street knowledge with me to a new place. And so I was very toxic to this new school and new environment I was in because of what I knew from where I came from.
Yeah. You're like, let me show you how to stab somebody with a pencil.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let me show you how to give somebody a paper cut real quick.
Did your school also, I remember in my elementary school, there was always those kids who'd pretend to be shooting up with a mechanical pencil. Were you that kid?
No, I wasn't that kid. No.
What school did you go to?
Cobb County.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Cobb County.
Well, you know, like when I was that age, right, you know, it shooting up was still super taboo. It was like, right, you could do anything as long as you didn't put a needle in your arm.
Right.
It was like, that was like the line that no one crossed. Yeah. And I think that's long gone now at this point in time.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the same when I grew up. People are just like, oh yeah, this is what we do now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a pretty effective way to get high, though, to be honest.
It's a pretty effective way to get paranoid, too.
Yeah. 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 And it's a pretty effective way to die, too. Right?
That, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So you start playing around like most people do, right? It's fun. It's recreational. You're rebelling. There's a youthful energy to it. There's, you know, it's not... hasn't taken over your life.
Right.
At what point does it begin to take over your life?
I guess it was more like high school age, once I started driving, you know, that young, innocent side of it was gone. Like, I, you know what I mean? I wanted something different. I wanted more. So I started indulging in more into like pills. Alcohol was always around. But I became introduced to opiates when I was in probably 11th grade, like when the Oxycontin epidemic was like at full force. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of benzos involved too, Xanaxes and Oxycontin. At that time, I started to, this is the part that's hard for me to admit, I started selling them, you know what I mean? Because it was like what I learned at a young age, like I can sell them and I can also use them and have fun with that. And people love me for that. Like, people think I'm cool because I'm the guy to go to.
And this was in high school?
Yeah, yeah, this was.
Yeah. Yeah. How much of that was like fitting in and being a, like, having a place in that little micro society?
All of 99%, I think, for me, it was.
Yeah.
98, 99, yeah, almost all of it.
Yeah, because it's like, I think what's common is that people, there's something about most of us, right, addicts, alcoholic types, where it's almost like we know something about the world or we kind of can see through people's masks and stuff. So there's almost, there's a sense of isolation and separation from the world.
Right.
And then we get into these communities at a young age and we don't feel that isolation anymore.
Right.
We feel a sense of belonging. Yeah. Do you feel like that was happening for you?
For sure. So a little bit farther of a backstory. I grew up pretty much as an only child. My father committed suicide at a very young age. I was only three. So I was learning how to be a man from my mother, from a woman's point of view, which was tough for her because she worked, you know, multiple jobs to make ends meet. Had a lot of free time and also a lot of alone time. And I've just really like came to terms with that and understood that, you know, the more clean time I have and the more recovery knowledge, like there were some underlying issues that I, like you just said, I needed a sense of fitting in or not being alone. And I found it in drugs and alcohol and in that role of others looking to me for their drugs and alcohol. So
how old were you when you found out that that's how your dad died?
I mean, I knew my whole life. I was there when it happened. I was in the house. So we lived in a little small house in Palmetto, Georgia. And I remember, this is how serious trauma can be. I remember the specific moment right after it happened. So I didn't see it. But my mom was in my bed with me. And then they had like an adjoining master bedroom where my dad committed suicide with a gun in the middle of the night. And I don't remember hearing a gunshot or anything like that, but I remember waking up, or my mom, I had this big cardboard box full of Lincoln Logs. Y'all remember Lincoln Logs, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I used to play with. And I remember just this one clip of her pushing that box to the opposite way, like to my living room, going, here, go play, go play, go play. And then I remember another vivid clip of me and her sitting on the front steps at that house as the police officers were walking up, and she's hysterical, and they're like patting her on the shoulder, and I was 3 years old. I don't even know like what I was thinking, but as an adult, I have these vivid memories of those two things that happened.
I mean, do you think that's like contributed to your use at such a young age?
I honestly don't know. Part of me says yeah, and part of me says no. Like, I think that contributed to me feeling alone. I think it contributed to me feeling alone in the world in a way, and then the drugs and alcohol kind of filled that void. So I guess the answer is yes.
Yeah, I mean, here's this person that's supposed to be the one that's going to provide for you and protect you and
right.
guide you through life. And they exit very dramatically, very yep. tragically, early in that process, right? So it does mm-hmm. leave you with kind of like no, like where do you stand now in life, right? I mean, it kind of right. removes that.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, I later learned that he was a person that struggled with drugs mainly. You know, and this was back in 1990, so there wasn't a lot of help or resources, and maybe that. That was the only way he knew out at yeah. that time. I don't really know. But yeah, it's definitely played a part in my life, my addiction, all of it, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so were you angry about that?
Yeah, at a young age, I think I was. You know, I acted out in school a lot, got suspended a lot, got in fights a lot, had problems with authority in general, and... you know, I remember like, you know, the school counselor, therapist, or yeah, the school counselors being like, you know, it's because he doesn't, you know, because his father and all this stuff. And at that time, I'm like, that ain't got nothing to do with it, you know, but obviously it did because I, you know,
yeah,
whatever. I didn't want to listen to anybody.
And you don't want your identity associated with that.
Right. right?
Like you're like, I'm not that, like
right.
you're trying to define your own way, you know? Yeah. I think that's normal and natural, right? Like as young people, we're trying to figure out reality in life and we're trying to get some handles. So you start to get into oxys and you're slanging them so you can use.
Yeah.
And what happens next?
Oh man.
Did you graduate high school?
I did. I graduated high school with honors, believe it or not. And I was probably
Hell yeah.
Probably there like half the time.
See,
Dean,
we got a good one, baby. If you can go all that high, baby, we got a good one now.
Yeah, I'm a keeper, huh?
Now we can start pushing them. Yeah.
Man, I didn't even graduate with honors.
I graduated with honors, with AB Honor Roll, yeah. You know, I had some possible college scholarships that I didn't even read or hear about. Wasn't trying to. I thought I had life figured out. Like, I got money in my pocket. And the way it played out was like, the house I grew up in Fairburn, Georgia, which is South Fulton County, my mom still owned it. And it was being built when my father passed away. So being that it was under development, they put half of it in my name as a 3-year-old child and half in her name. So when I graduated high school, I immediately went to work with my hands. You know what I mean? I went to work for my best friend's uncle's sprinkler company, putting in fire sprinklers. So straight into construction, you know, like I'm going to make $12 an hour and get rich and I'm good, you know? So, yeah. So I went straight into that. And my mom, you know, is like, well, you seem to be doing good. You got a job. You graduated high school. Why don't you just take over payments on the house? Because she was using it as a rental property at that time. And I was like, awesome, you know, even better. Just take over the payments and I'll own a home. So I moved over there. And I'm back in Fulton County, which, you know, is where I came from as a child. And now I'm back there. And it was kind of like, in my mind, like the cops were way worse in Coweta. So it was like a sigh of relief. Like, I can go to my home in Fulton County now and continue to use and continue to sell drugs without so much paranoia.
Yeah.
And so then it really started getting out of control though. Like, you know, then I had, I don't even know. Then I had, people moving in and out, renting rooms and in my mind, I was still just having fun. You know what I mean? I'm not even old enough to drink yet. And I had my own house. Like, I had cars, I had a good job I had a lot of friends, so I thought like I thought I was on the right track.
Yeah,
it appeared that way.
Yeah.
You know, and I was still a very high functioning addict during most of this, during all of this. So I thought I was doing good, man. And then I let's see, and where does it go next? Then I kind of switched careers throughout that, all in construction, but I got into remodeling with my uncle. You know, I've got four uncles. So they were kind of like my male role models growing up. And I go to work with my uncle remodeling, and I'm really good at it. And I learn, I'm making good money. And I kind of start to do my own thing on the side and got a little business starting to form. Well, then, then I met a girl, and she had a 1-year-old daughter when I met her. And her name is Carly. She's now 14. And I will always claim her as my daughter because I raised her for the next 10 years. Her father was also an active addiction, and he is now deceased. But I raised her for the next 10 years, and I also had my first son, who is Cameron. He is now 10. So now I'm still in active addiction, and I'm still hustling on the side, and I've got my own little business going. And I've got a family started, so I'm really like, you know, I'm really feeling myself like I'm doing life, like I'm really doing it. I'm successful. Look at me. How could I be a drug addict or an alcoholic if I have these things? Like, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, right.
You know, so.
Yeah, that's that. I've heard people say like it was obvious I was powerless. Right. But the unmanageability is what people struggle with, right?
Right.
Because they have the house and the car and the money. And they,
right.
What's unmanageable about this, right?
Yeah.
When did you go, oh, shit, yeah, I can't manage this?
18 months ago. So.
When did you start thinking like, okay, this might be.
I'm trying to put a time on it. I guess when I really started, so the pills turned into heroin, no needles, but just snorting it. So I still, in my mind, was managing because I'm not a needle user.
Yeah.
I'm just a drug addict, and I still go to work every day, and I still pay my bills and all, you know, still managing. And, somewhere around there, I'm thinking like 2000, I don't know, probably 10, 11, I decided that maybe I should try a methadone clinic. And get some professional, you know, medication so that I'm not buying it off the street. And I'd been arrested God knows how many times at this point, probably 15 or 20.
For possession?
For drugs in general. Possession with intent, trafficking, DUI, you know, a lot of wrecked cars, just nonsense. I mean, I used to struggle with the fact of being an alcoholic and a drug addict because I'm like, my problem was with drugs, not alcohol. But truthfully, like the first time I ever drank Patron is the first time I ever went to jail. And that's got alcoholic stamped all over it. You know what I mean? Like, where was I though? What was the question?
Yes. Well, so you're starting to get arrested. You're going, maybe I need to manage this better.
Right.
It's not the drugs. It's the kind of drugs I'm doing. So yep. Let me get legal version of it.
So I start going to a methadone clinic. And for anybody watching that don't know what that consists of, it means that you go to a methadone clinic every single day, 6 days a week, and you pay them $10, $12, $13, $15 now. Some of them now are more like $15, I've heard. But I went there every day for like 3 years. And gave them folks $12 every single morning, and they give me a little bottle with, you know, a lot of methadone in it, like way more than anybody should ever have. Like they started me on like 40 milligrams, had me on to 80 that Friday, to where I was so high on methadone, like, and then my mind is still telling me like I'm managing better now, like I'm doing all right now. Because this came from a doctor. Somebody approved this. Like, this isn't just me. So I really thought, you know
somebody
what I'm saying?
Approved this.
Somebody else.
Somebody up higher than me was like, this is okay.
Yeah. So I did that for a long, long time, you know. But the Xanaxes were still there during the methadone treatment. You know what I mean? I was still doing shit my way, and it. Because I, you know, didn't get arrested for, you know, a good 6 months or something. I thought I was doing better.
Yeah.
Had you ever tried to get clean or sober before 18 months ago? Or was it just like you're trying to manage your medications on your own?
I did try. Not very hard, though. I tried, you know, probably 6 months before that.
Okay.
No, that's not true. That's not true. So I really tried to just solemnly quit the first time in 2018, which is where everything turned upside down. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead and get into that now. Yeah.
Get into it? Okay. Yeah. So this is where everything really changed for me. I decide, okay, me and Kim, the mother of my kids, is split up, you know, and I'm trying to figure it out. I'm trying to get my family back. I'm trying to get my life on track. So I tell my mom and the mother of my kids, I'm going to go to my mom's house and just sweat it out cold turkey. I'm just going to quit. And I'm talking about heroin and Xanaxes at the same time. I'm just going to tough it out because that's all I knew. I didn't know, you know, how much help was out here. I didn't know how many resources there were. I didn't know. I thought AA was something that Charlie Sheen did on TV. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. Right.
I didn't know. So I decided I'm going to sweat it out. And 4 days into it, you know, as I was getting over, like, or really going through the middle of the worst, I get a text from Kroger that says I have a refill to pick up for the Xanaxes. And I'm feeling loopy, and I'm physically sick, and I'm all messed up. So I'm like, maybe I should go get the Xanaxes and let my mom give them to me or let somebody hold them and just get my brain back right. Well, I call Kim, the mother of my kids, and she's at the pool with the kids. And I didn't even tell her what I needed or anything. She's like, you know, I'm at the pool. What do you need? I'm like, never mind. I hung up. I called my mom, and she was in the bed, didn't feel good. So I decided to hop in my truck and go to Kroger and get this medicine, right? I get 7 miles from the house and have a seizure due to the withdrawal of the Xanaxes while I'm stopped at a red light. When I seized up, I mashed the gas to the floor in a four-wheel drive Chevy Avalanche and went 3/4 of a mile off the road, got up to about 75 miles an hour and hit a tree dead center. And I don't remember any of this. I do have pictures, and I've talked to, like, eyewitnesses that found me after this event. I hit a tree 75 miles an hour, the motor comes through the cab of the truck and it cuts my left leg off immediately. But it also pinched the skin so I didn't bleed out. It crushed my right leg, mangled it into pieces, knocked half my teeth out on the left side. It snapped my arm. And that, you know, that's where it started. Because the recovery from this car accident is really where things got out of control for me. So they show up to get me out of the truck, and I don't remember any of this. Thank God for that. They take an hour to cut me out of the vehicle. They put me in a helicopter and fly me from Palmetto to Atlanta Medical Center, where they said I lost 95% of my blood in the 11-minute flight that it took to get there. I lost 95% of my blood. They get me into the ICU surgery, start trying to button everything up, and both of my lungs collapse, one after the other. So now I've got, you know, a half a body and staples and stitches, and they're now having to insert chest tubes all down both sides to try to get the fluid out of my lungs. Mm-hmm. They somehow get me stable, put me into a medical-induced coma and life support, put a trach in my throat to breathe, you know, have a ventilator breathing for me. And during all this chaos, so when the first responders came, the firefighters and the EMTs come, I'm in this truck and it's registered to me, the tags in my name, I have a wallet with my ID in it, but because it wasn't a death, they didn't have to notify anybody. So nobody knows that I even left the house to go to Kroger and get some medication. They just know I'm there detoxing, trying to get better by my damn self. And mm-hmm. So they flew me to Atlanta, didn't know my name. They couldn't ask me. So they listed me in the computer at Atlanta Medical Center as Saline Solution was my name.
Oh, shit. Not even John Doe.
Not even John Doe.
Oh, you need a Saline Solution shirt, dog. That's what you need.
They don't use John Doe anymore. I found out
they
later.
Use saline solution.
Saline solution.
Apparently.
Bro. Yeah.
Was your neighbor morphine drip?
Like, yeah, right. It was something wild like
bucket
that. It absolutely
mop,
was. Yeah.
Know,
just whatever.
Just whatever they saw at the
whatever
time.
They're looking at. Yeah,
two
yeah.
dogs fucking. Yep. Okay. That's yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah. White scrubs, you know.
White scrubs. Just, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Whatever they were looking at, I guess. I don't know how they do it, but they did. And so I'm in a coma. I'm on life support in Atlanta, and nobody knows where I'm at. Like, nobody even knows that I left. So then I got my mom, who knew, you know, my mom and the mother of my kids both know that I'm there detoxing by myself, and they don't know anything else. Well, then I just disappear and don't come home. You know what I mean? And so then they get together, like, what happened to Chad? Where'd he go?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This ain't like him. He wouldn't just leave the kids for multiple days. So they call every jail and every hospital, but they're looking for Chad Smith, and I'm not listed. So
this is a saline solution. That's all that.
Yeah, saline yeah. solution is all they knew. And so yeah. I spent 8 days there under that name.
Now, how did they discover who you were? How did that?
Yeah. Oh, man, my poor mama. She... My mama's a saint. Let me just say that. Mom, if you're watching, I love you. And she's just a genuine good person. Like, and I love her for that. So she, you know, has always been like one of my biggest advocate. You know what I mean? She's never experienced drugs or alcohol. She's just a good person. So she goes to the local sheriff's department, the Cowee de County Sheriff's Department, where they know me extremely well from all the arrests and the trouble I caused in my younger age. Like, hey, I'm looking for my son. He disappeared a week ago. I need to file a missing person report. And they're like, she tells him the name. And he's like, oh yeah, Chad. He was in a really bad car accident. I don't think he made it. And she's like, what, you know, well, what did you do with him? How do I find out? And they're like, well, so they look on their computer like, oh, well, he was life flighted to Atlanta Medical Center. You'll have to call them to get an update. So she went round and round with them and finally figured out I'm listed as saline solution in the basement, you know, God. Pretty much lifeless, my lifeless body in ICU. So it was an experience.
Bro, her drive up to that.
I can't imagine.
I can't imagine that.
You know, I mean, I feel like it was definitely more traumatic for her and also my ex that way. Because I didn't remember any of this. All I really remember is waking up. You know, like,
yeah, well, because you had the seizure, which started it all, and you were already out of it from the withdrawals,
right?
Right. So,
And keep in mind, now I'm still fully detoxing from two different drugs, but I'm also like unconscious and unresponsive. So the hospital and the EMTs, nobody knew that. So while I'm in this coma and on life support, I'm sure that my body was still fully detoxing and, you know, seasoned and God only knows what, and nobody knew.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it was an experience.
So how long till you come out of the coma?
I was in the coma, I believe, for about 9 weeks. Wow. And the crazy part about that, so my mom is, like I was saying, she's just a down-to-earth Southern lady. My ex at the time was in nursing school, so she was able to talk to the doctors, but she couldn't make any legal decisions because we weren't married. Mm-hmm. So she's able to talk to him, understand it, and then relay that message to my mother. My mother makes a decision on what to do and how to proceed with whatever. So they, you know, so it worked out that way. Well, they tell Kim, my ex, the doctors tell Kim, Chad's not getting any better, and it's time to pull the plug. And this is 2 days before my birthday, and I'm in this coma, and I'm on life support. And I'm not showing any signs of improvement.
When's your birthday?
October 19th.
Oh, okay, you're Libra.
I'm a Libra.
Why do you
October
know that?
22nd.
Oh.
Nice.
Not just like all astrological.
There are people who are like that. No. I just did not pin you as
I'm
one
I'm October
of them.
22nd. That's how I know. Okay, cool.
Super cool.
Yeah.
That's why we get along.
That's
we're,
right.
We're balanced that way.
Yes, that's it.
So 2 days before my birthday, they go to Kim. We're going to pull the plug. You need to prepare the family to pull the plug, meaning my mom. You know, and Kim refuses. She's like, no way. His birthday's in 2 days. Give him two more days. He's going to pull through. And I did. I started to come around on my birthday.
Wow.
Like literally reborn on my birthday.
So what was that like? Like, was your last memory in the car or was your last memory at home?
My last memory was getting in the car.
So you get in the car and then the next thing you know, you're in a hospital and you're missing a leg.
Correct.
What was that?
Okay, well, there was a little bit in between. Like, there was a little bit of stuff that happened in a coma and on this life support. Like, some of it was hallucinations. There was some dark stuff there. And then there was some stuff that actually happened. I had an old running buddy get arrested on the news, and the news was playing in my hospital room. And when I woke up, I knew that he had went to jail for... Well, we won't get into that. He went to jail, and it was accurate. And they're like, how could you know that? You were in a coma when that happened. Right. And it was just so, like, it was kind of like in and out. But there was some very scary stuff that happened, too, and that was a very real part of it. I remember, not, it could have been 10 minutes or it could have been 10 days, but I remember laying in the hospital bed and seeing the Grim Reaper, like, full detailed Grim Reaper standing in the corner of my hospital room, pitchfork and everything. No facial features, just a dark presence there, like just like you would see in a movie.
What'd you tell him?
I didn't tell him shit. I was terrified. I didn't tell him anything at all.
I
tried not to move so he wouldn't notice me. You know what I mean?
Like, wait,
I
I'm was sorry. I'm hung up on out. Pitchfork? Not a Sith.
No, yeah, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
You know, the
I was gonna say you have the redneck.
Ask the goth girl.
Right. What did I call it?
What the fucking
you
Grim Reaper
it a pitchfork. You have the redneck Grim Reaper at your hospital.
I did. It was actually Dean. It was actually Dean. He had a cowboy hat and everything.
Did he show you his tummy?
Yeah. No. Did I say pitchfork?
You did.
But you knew what I meant. Thank you.
You said pitchfork. I was really curious.
Was it actually a pitchfork instead of a Sith or a sickle or whatever they call
it? Well, maybe his Grim Reaper is a farmer and
he came all the way from Cowee to County to get
he did.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's these lucid. Do you have a lot of those memories? Of those
there's only one more specific, like, dark memory. And there was, I remember laying in the hospital bed and there was crows circling, like, flying above me.
Wow.
You know, and I've told people this before, you know, like, and they always say, what do you think that means? And in my mind, it means that I was that close to death and I wasn't living right when it happened. And it scared the shit out of me. It was terrifying. And it seemed like it lasted for days, just laying there, like, fully petrified to where I couldn't move.
Yeah.
You know, and I probably also couldn't move, but...
Right. Yeah, you're trapped in your mind, in a sense.
Yeah, it was...
Right.
So was it... Did it... it was, like, have you ever had sleep paralysis? Oh, well, you're lucky. But it sounds like that it was just like really prolonged sleep paralysis.
Sounds
like
horrible. When
you get, have you had sleep paralysis?
Yeah, I got that.
Yeah, it's not fun.
No, it's horrible.
But that's what that sounds like, just on 9 weeks of it being met by hillbilly.
No, no.
The hillbilly Grim Reaper. Reaper.
Yeah. Overall,
your Grim Reaper's name was Chuck.
That's right. How'd you know?
He also works at the Walmart on the weekends.
That's why, and that's why you've had crows. Like, he was just the scarecrow for you. Like, he was like, I'm keeping you safe from these birds, man.
Yeah. Oh, man.
He wasn't the Reaper. He was
the scarecrow.
He was a scarecrow.
He was just a scarecrow.
You're actually the Wizard of Oz.
Dang, man. Why didn't somebody just wake me up and tell me? That's so much easier to handle. Like, it was actually just the Halloween decorations for the hospital. You know what I mean? And it could have been.
It could have been.
I don't know, but it was too
much. Would a hospital decorate for Halloween? I feel like that'd be kind of twisted.
Yeah, I don't know.
Astro-wing.
I don't know either.
Well, we'll find out, because definitely don't put anything scary in the coma patient rooms.
They should, though.
But when they wake you up, tell me about that, because you come to, right? Or at least you become enough out of the coma that they go, oh, we don't have to pull the plug, right?
Right.
So what do you, but when you do kind of get conscious, right?
Yeah.
Don't they, because I think there's a part of that, right? Because they have to, they're trying to prepare you for what you're about to realize really shortly, right?
Right. And it's weird because, like I was saying a minute ago, I was in and out a lot. Not like consciously, but I guess maybe subconsciously. I don't know, but I was in and out, and I kind of knew when I woke up that I'd lost my leg.
You already knew that?
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, and then it was still a shocking thing to wake up and look down and see it, you know, because they had gadgets and stuff hooked up every type of which way, and suction pumps, and then my right leg was in this giant brace with screws and pins, and, you know, it was a lot.
Yeah.
It was a lot. But I didn't panic. Like, a lot of people just assume or thought that I would panic, like wake up and just freak out, and I didn't do that. I think because, you know, I kind of knew that this stuff had happened to me.
Yeah.
You know.
Now.
And woke up that way.
You know, you kind of tell a short version of this to people who ask, you know, what happened, right?
Right.
And usually people will ask, oh, so did you stop getting high after that?
Yeah.
Right.
Joey, I hear you laughing in there, bro.
Because your answer is so, proof of how sinister this disease is.
Yeah. So that's. So my guy Joey in there on the ones and twos asked me that just the other day. When I guess it was probably my, when was that? Monday or so that y'all were. And he's like, yeah, man, so that's a terrible story, man. Did you stop getting high for that? And I was like, no. Then I really started getting high away, like times 10, you know what I mean? I wish.
Now you had a great reason to, right?
Your brain was probably like, oh, this is, we try to get clean. This is, we lose our leg. Like, might as well.
Right. Well, trying to grasp all that, the thought of getting clean wasn't even there anymore. Then it was like prescription after prescription and all this different stuff, you know, that put me in the situation in the first place. But now I've got all this pain and all these issues. So of course my addictive brain is like, well, once again, like the methadone, like a doctor said it was okay, so it's okay, and this has to be the only way because a doctor said so, you know. So no, I didn't get clean after that. I wish I could say that I did after such a horrific, you know, tragedy, but no.
In some ways, I mean, it makes sense. Like, it's because you now everything's up in the air, right? And your life has been just permanently changed, right? Yeah. And so when we don't have the tools of recovery inside of us, and we face painful things and tough things and challenges, we're going to naturally go back to the thing that used to work, which is getting high. Right. Mm-hmm. And so to me, it makes a lot of sense. You didn't have any recovery in you to tell you that there was a better way.
Right.
So all you knew was drugs always made me feel better. I'm going to go back to that thing because this is really hard.
Yeah.
And you talked about not even like knowing the resources for recovery. So 18 months ago, like, is that when that changed? Or did you ever know anyone in recovery? Like, what introduced you to, hey, there is a better way to do this?
Well, that's kind of like a whole other story. I guess it came. Okay, so I'm just going to ease into that. I'm going to continue the story just a little bit, and then we'll get right into that. So no, I didn't get clean. I continued to get high, and I continued to use, but it was prescribed, and I justified it that way. And then when that ran out and the Medicaid that the hospital gave me stopped, I went back to the street because that's what I knew. Like you said a second ago, that was the easy fix. So it went right back into heroin and Xanaxes. And I'd gave up on life, man. I sat in that just broken state and used. And I wasn't the type to ever really isolate. Like I was the one that wanted to get high and party with you and have fun and all this stuff. And once I became disabled, I really spent a lot of time by myself. And that led to some more arrests and some more charges. In a freaking wheelchair, bro. Like,
yeah, it's gonna be hard to outrun the cops in a wheelchair, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So just a real quick, I won't go into all of it, but
I think you told me that this walker that we got out here.
Yeah, yeah.
It's your OG walker. It's been in jail with you.
Yeah, yeah. The last
time. I didn't even put two and two together to think how horrible it would be to be in jail.
Yeah, it was terrible, dude.
Yeah.
It was terrible. And that's, that kind of rolls right into Sarah's question. So the last arrest, I caught some new drug charges down in Griffin, Georgia, in Spalding County. Place I ain't had no business being, trying to help somebody move, you know, just some dumb stuff to even be involved in. But I was there, I got arrested, got some new charges. And right before this car accident, I got arrested for trafficking methamphetamine about 3 weeks before this car accident, with a couple ounces of methamphetamine. Made bond, got out, decided to detox myself, wake up 3 months later in the hospital with no legs. And the head surgeon of the hospital had wrote a letter to the courthouse saying, hey, this guy's not going to make it to court. We don't even know if he's going to make it to tomorrow. You know what I mean? So they dropped the charge, but they dropped it without prejudice, which means they can bring it back at any time. So I get home from the hospital the day before Thanksgiving. And within, like, I don't know, 10 days, I get a letter from the courthouse re-indicted for trafficking methamphetamine. So I'm in and out of court for that, thinking they'll have pity on me, because I'm now a disabled, handicapped person. And they're like, no, sir, we have prisons built just for you. They did not care. And it took a lot of money and a lot of lawyers to get it dropped down to possession with intent and a 10-year probation sentence. I didn't make it 6 months, and I got three new drug charges, cell cases, in another county where I can't bond out because I'm on probation. Hire a lawyer, spend another $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. Calling my mama, my dear old sweet mama. Mama, I did it again. Like, I need you to transfer some money out of my account and go hire a lawyer and make sure he's a good one, because I really fucked it up this time, you know. So I spent 3 months in Cowee County with that walker. They wouldn't let me have a wheelchair. They said it could be used as a weapon. But they gave me a walker.
What you going to do, run over someone's foot?
That's what I said. I broke it down like this. I said, man, if I have the wheelchair, I'm sitting in it, so I can't necessarily use it that way as a weapon. If I'm standing up holding this walker, I can most definitely hit you in the throat with it, right, before I fall. Right. Before I fall, I'm going to hit you with it. Yeah. But that was their, you know, that was their rule. And so I hopped around with one leg in a tied up jumpsuit, and that exact walker is on the front balcony right now, for 3 months. Court date came up. I had a good lawyer, and he's like, look, Chad, we're going to give you another chance to get out and go to treatment. Court-ordered rehab. I had 120 days to get in somewhere because of the handicap part of it. You know, he had bought me some more time because he knew it was going to be a little bit tougher. You know, and so in my mind, I'm like, awesome, I got 4 months to go out here and fuck around before I really have to do anything serious about it. I wait till, you know, the 119th day 11 o'clock at night and checked myself into a state detox down in Noonan. And I'm thinking that's good enough. That's an inpatient treatment. And the court didn't see it that way, so they issued a warrant. Got me again. Wait a minute, these stories are confused somewhere. So I spent like a month in jail. I got out with 120 days to go. I went to a state detox. They violated me because that's not what they told me to do. I get back out. They give me another chance to go to treatment. And I had until December of 2022 to get in somewhere. And I couldn't. I didn't have any insurance. I didn't have any money to go to these, you know, expensive places. And there's my sweet old mama again calling around trying to figure out how to make it work for me. And I had just given up. Like, I'm just going to go serve some time. This treatment's not really an option. Well, she ran, you know, she talked to somebody, a guy that said, hey, call Mary over with Hope Dealers. Yeah. Get in touch with Mary. get emotional talking about that. Oh, get in touch with Mary. And she's like, yeah, I got you. We can get you on some insurance and get you into treatment, you know, ASAP. Like, this was the end of November, so she's like, in December, on December 1st, the insurance will kick in and you can go to treatment. And they had it all set up for me to go to Black Bear Lodge on December, I think it was December 6th of 22. And that's when I really, to answer Sarah's question, that's when I really first learned that there is some help out here. Was still kind of unsure about it, you know what I mean? Still didn't fully trust it, but went with it.
Well, because they don't just get you the insurance, right? Like, they got you the insurance. They're coordinating you to get there. They keep in contact with you as you're leading up to the day. And, yeah. Right? It's not just like they got you insurance. Like, they're taking you through this whole process. So it's the first time someone's ever led you to a solution.
Of course. Yeah, and she called, you know, every day just to check on me leading up to that first day of treatment, which was, you know, a new experience to me. Like, somebody that from the outside world, outside of, like, my mom, my immediate family that actually genuinely cares for my well-being was new. Like, I was still like, I don't know. There's got to be an ulterior motive. That can't be real. And so, but it was. And I went, you know, and because I was court ordered, I totally screwed it up immediately. I was there for like 7 days and had taken some Xanaxes into the tree, snuck them in, that and a cell phone.
Wait, how did you sneak in the Xanax?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not easy to do. And I had, what'd you do?
The wheelchair.
So I went in the wheelchair. And if you're looking at it, you see the little plastic caps on the ends there. Mm-hmm. And you just pop one off and I slid them in there, of course. And
you might be a junkie, yeah.
right.
You might be doing your wheelchair to sneak Xanax is into treatment.
That's terrible, dude. That is freaking terrible.
Yeah, so you hadn't surrendered fully. You were just doing the process because you needed to.
I was doing it for temporary way out.
When did you surrender? When did you go, okay, I'm done. I need to do something.
So they kicked me out of Black Bear and they flew me to South Georgia to Willing Way, where I also manipulated the situation. Like, oh, I can only stay here until December 31st because I don't want to pay another out of pocket, you know, $1,200 or whatever going into the new year. So they went for it. They let me graduate in 17 days and I went home and thought, you know, it was an AA based program. And I thought, like, this doesn't apply to me because I'm a drug addict, not an alcoholic. Well, I went home and made it about 9 days and went to Olive Garden with my mom. And I'll never forget the moment the lady brought out the coasters and it has that big blue moon with the orange slice on it, you know. And I was like, yeah, I want one of those. And my mom doesn't know any better. I mean, she's thinking the same thing I am. It's legal and you're under control and you're not driving. And it was all right, you know, that night and even a couple of days into it. But I started to drink, you know, pretty steadily. And I had met some people, you know, at the treatment center while I was down there. Luckily, one I was still in contact with is like, Chad, you have a problem with alcohol, too. I'm like, why you say that, you know? And she's like, well, are you drinking right now? And I'm like, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, so anyway, you know, at that point, I wasn't, you know, I was done with the probation side of it. Not done with probation, but the court order to go. I completed it. And I was like, you know, somewhat sober enough to think clearly and realize that I missed something. Like I did these two different little treatments, but it wasn't enough time to really gain any insight to what's wrong with me. So in January, I decided to call Mary back, who's also an earthly angel. I'm like, Mary, I think I missed something because now I'm drinking and, you know, it's not really my thing, but it's getting out of control. And so she, you know, jumped right in and got me signed up to go to Recovery Village. And that's where I really fully surrendered and learned about me. Had some time to sit, you know, and reflect and diagnose what's going on inside of me that I have to have a substance to feel good. And I ended up spending 2 months there. And that's where I count my recovery time starting was the day I checked myself into there.
Yeah.
You know, and that led to, I left there this time willing to go to sober living afterwards and an IOP program that I also completed. You know, like I had this continuous behavior in my life of starting things and not following through. So I'm like, I got to do it different. I've got to complete it. Even if I don't think I'm getting anything from it, I signed up to do it. So I did it. And really started gaining some insight and some skills on how to navigate life as not only a sober person, but a disabled person, which is a whole separate struggle. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Man. Well, you know, like I was telling somebody on the phone, you know, like I see Chad comes in every day, you know, and everything he has to do to get up in here, into this studio.
Right.
Right. You know, lock his wheelchair up downstairs, hops up on the stairs. And when we talked before we brought you on, I said, look, there's a real issue here. You know, like you've always kept around. You always kept, hey, what's up? What's up? What's up? So I'm like, we need to give you a shot. But I'm like, there's a real issue here, right? There's no elevator,
right,
and we're upstairs on the second floor.
Yeah.
So, and I remember you saying really clearly, pretty adamantly, don't let that be a determinant. Don't let that affect your decision.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And watching you go through all the steps you have to go through just to get in here, right, makes me walk the steps a little different, honestly. But it's showing that you there's something in you, right? That the same thing that woke you up in the hospital.
Yeah.
There's something in you that goes, I want more. I want to live.
Yeah.
And you're not going to let this hold you back, right? And that's beautiful to see. It's inspiring. And, you know, we're grateful to have you around. And I'm really hopeful that what we can do in a 6 months, I think we can give you the foundations to really shift your career. You know,
yeah,
there's so many different facets in the entertainment industry, the places where you can work, whether it's logistics or whether it's, you know, post-production or administration. There's so much stuff. And I think that as long as you stay willing and you keep pushing yourself, you keep learning and growing, it really could turn into something that really will change the trajectory of your life.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love that part of it, but also I do it because I was always deep in the streets, like in the wrong ways, and now I kind of look at it as an opportunity to give back, you know what I mean, to show people there is a way out, because I was a guy that was like, you know, rehab's for quitters and for weak-minded people, and that is the exact opposite, you know what I mean? Like, I learned real quick it's for the strong that continue to fight and push forward.
Amen.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah,
all right. And what we like to do as we close is, this is your camera over here, is what you would like to say to somebody who's out there and who's considering this way of life, considering making a change. What would you say to that person if they asked you what they need to do?
Well, I think first I would say reach out for help, man. You're not alone. It feels that way a lot of times in addiction or trying to navigate that first part of a recovery journey. It did for me. You know, I didn't realize the love that was out here, you know, in these rooms and these meetings and these fellowships. So reach out for help. And I say all the time, there's three parts to, like, my program, and it's to ask for help, be open to receive help, and then give help back. So you gotta ask for some help. You gotta be open to receive it, and then you gotta be willing to give it back. When you gain something from it, you gotta give it back to continue this thing.
Amen.
Yeah.
Thanks, man. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Yes, sir.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's say thanks to Chad for very transparently sharing that. If you need help, reach out. We are here. Thank you to all the donors and supporters who make this show and documentaries and training spaces and 90 lessons of Montana Society possible. This has been the Most High Show.